This is Amber Rose Washington, music producer and author of the best-selling book, Hiding From Myself. And you're listening to the Ghosts in the Valley podcast.
Hello and welcome to Ghost in the Valley podcast. I'm your host, Al Cooley. Today I have Namar Slevic. Namar is the author of UFOs Over Maine. He is a researcher, a writer, an investigator in numerous aspects of the paranormal. He shares his stories through his books, documentaries, and his podcast. Namar has been fascinated with the paranormal since childhood. He has had a UFO encounter when he was only 4 years old. In adulthood, he has shared his passion through research, his writings on UFOs, and his extraterrestrial encounters. Besides UFOs Over Maine, Namar has also written Granite Skies and Other Unworldly Encounters. I see we have a lot to talk about, Namar. Welcome to the show.
Thanks so much for having me. I appreciate it.
Before we get into your books and your podcast, let's talk about, I have a circle here on my paper. You've had a UFO experience when you were 4 years old.
Yeah, that was the first one of many, apparently. I had gone to bed and something woke me up in the middle of the night. I think it was a loud bang and my eyes kind of popped open and I was looking around for some sort of like explanation. And I started to hear soft taps at my window and I realized it was rain. And I saw the sky light up and I was like, oh, it was thunder. Thunder woke me up. And then I was like, oh, a thunder and lightning storm. So I kneeled up on my bed and was looking out the window. And at the time, I lived in Fort Kent, Maine. Fort Kent, Maine is at the tip of Maine. Mm-hmm. And it's just across the St. John River from Canada. So my parents' apartment building looked over the St. John River and I could see it like raging, you know, below me. And above me, the sky was lighting up and I was hearing booms. And then just after, a few moments, there was this really intense lightning bolt. Like if I were to ask you to draw one, you would draw this jagged yellow line. Uh-huh. And it was stuck in a cloud. And even at like 4 years old, I knew that you saw lightning in just an instant. I see this lightning bolt and it's stuck in a cloud. And there's kind of like, you know, that halo effect that you get like around the moon and stuff at night. And there was electricity coming off of the lightning bolt and there was more booms associated with it. And then I'm not sure what happened after that. I fell back asleep and woke up the next morning. I went to the bathroom and when I was done, I was walking back to my bedroom. And I could see out my window and see the sky and the lightning bolt was still there. So I thought that was strange. And I ran downstairs to get my dad and I brought him all the way upstairs to look out the window. I don't know why we just didn't go outside, but we ran upstairs to look at my window and it was gone. So I was trying to explain to him about the storm the night before and that there was this lightning bolt that got stuck in a cloud. And he was kind of doing the thing that adults do when a child is saying something insane. And he's like, yeah, okay, buddy. Yeah, but I must have been pretty insistent because he had to like get down on my level, like kneel down, put his hands on my shoulders and was like, buddy, like it didn't even rain last night. I'm really not sure what you're talking about. And that really was that. When you're 4 years old, the next thing caught my attention and I sort of forgot about it. A couple weeks later, I'm being woken up again in the middle of the night, but this time it's my dad who's waking me up. And he brings me downstairs and I can see my sister and my mother. And my mother is like shoving my sister into her winter clothes, you know, uh-huh. And she gets done with her and comes over to me and starts doing the same thing to me. And then my dad scoops me up and we all walk outside and it's the middle of the night to me, you know, so I don't know if that's 9 p.m. or 3 a.m., you know, but we go outside and my dad keeps telling me to look up, but I'm freezing. You know, this is northern Maine in the winter. And I'm like, ah, and my head's just buried in his chest. And he's telling me to look up, look up. And so I finally do. And I see these beautiful ribbons of like greens and reds, and I'm seeing the northern lights. Mm-hmm. And it's the only time I've ever seen them. I can still remember it like yesterday, just like that lightning bolt. So at a really young age, I'm pretty sure I created some core memories associating strangeness with the sky. Mm-hmm. And that kind of became my catalyst to pay attention and to seek out all things strange going forward, you know, but that's kind of like Nomar's origin story, if you will.
Well, that's pretty cool. I mean, you know, to think of, remember something not long ago, you know, 4 years old.
Yeah.
That had to be a pretty big impact. So I'm saying here, maybe this is what kickstarted your love into the paranormal, or was there something else?
I really think that was it. During that time, and I think a little older, my mother is still to this day really into horror movies. And she got me into horror movies. And I saw my first one, maybe probably a little too young, maybe 7, 8 years old. And I think it was Phantasm was the first one.
Oh, yeah. I love that show.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, great. And so that kind of fueled my fascination for the macabre, you know. And she also had really interesting stories of a haunting that occurred in the home she grew up in. And she had a big family, a bunch of brothers and sisters. And she was telling me different stuff that they all experienced. And, I was just fascinated by that. But it wasn't until I was like 12, 13 years old when I thought back to that lightning bolt. Mm-hmm. And that's where I started to convince myself, like, that was probably a UFO. And my 4-year-old mind didn't know how to see that any other way than a lightning bolt or something, you know? Uh-huh. And because there was like electricity coming off of the lightning bolt, I'm wondering like if the storm was like assumed by me, but it wasn't really storming, but I was just seeing a sky lighting up and I was hearing booms and, you know, maybe it wasn't really storming, or the UFO was causing the storm. I don't know. And I don't know.
Or could it have been mental telepathy through the UFO?
Yeah, absolutely. That could be my screen memory, because what I remember is waking up the next morning. Uh-huh. You know, so is there some sort of deep-seated thing that I've never, you know, regressed, you know, gotten out of me yet? You know, that's certainly possible.
I see that you're an investigator. Are you a paranormal investigator?
I was for a lot of years. I had a team and we looked into hauntings.
That was my next question. If you had a team and how many was on your team and how diversified you were.
We had like 7 at our largest, but it was typically like a 4- and 5-man crew for most of the investigations. And we did that for roughly 10 years. Towards the last 3 years, it was a little bit more sporadic as life changes were happening for a lot of us. And it got a little bit more sporadic. And eventually, like, I came out with this book and somebody had a baby. So we disbanded for, you know, we thought it was temporary and it ended up being permanent, you know. But we did mostly residential, caught some really interesting EVPs. We caught some interesting stuff on camera. And we loved absolutely doing it, you know. During that time, I was also fielding UFO reports, but that was more so on the side. And also at the same time, I was working on my first book, you know, while I was on that team. So I was doing a lot of research as opposed to going out for like quote unquote UFO investigations. And I don't know if you've ever done a UFO investigation, but in my experience, it's like even more boring than paranormal investigating, because really, it's very reactive. You know what I mean? Like you're going there. If something recent happens, you're going on site hours to weeks after the event occurred. You know, what do you expect to find? You know, at the time I had a Geiger counter, you know, so I would sweep the area for, you know, stuff like that. I've never had it once go higher than normal background levels, you know? I also would look for, scorched grass, especially when fields were involved. I'd look for landing sites. I would look for like tops of trees to maybe be broken or, you know, something like that. But there's not a whole lot to go on with a UFO investigation. It's a lot with speaking with the experiencer and getting their story. And a lot of that is, you know, it's a mental health issue. A lot of times people don't really know how to deal with their encounter, and I've had a lot of sightings, and I don't know how to deal with them either, other than write them down and process through that as much as I can. But a lot of times, especially with Mainers, we're very reserved, to speak generally of the people here, and people don't want to come across as crazy. Of course, there's been a stigma with UFO reports for years, and that's finally like just starting to get better. Mm-hmm. So a lot of times I speak with people in secret, if you will, meaning they want to use a pseudonym, or they want to be anonymous completely. And I've gotten some really great reports, and they know that I'm an author and I'm also looking to feed like a book or a podcast or something, and they're like, you know what? I'm so glad I got this off my chest. You were very kind, but I don't want you using the story at all. And all I can be like is okay. All I can do is.
Yeah, I know what you're saying, that they don't want to get their name used. They'll give you a whole bunch of vital information. Vital information. Man, I like to put that out there. I can't, Yeah. I know what you're talking about on the down low,
Yeah. And it's so important to honor that. And it's so hard for a lot of people to tell these stories that. At the least amount I want to be for them is a kind, non-judgmental ear. And if that's all it is, cool. And I would say, 40% of the time, that is what it is. I'm just a kind, non-judgmental ear. And they're like, oh, thanks so much. I feel so much better. I'm like, cool, thanks. And I wrote it all down, but it goes nowhere,
It's like this show, and I never judge anybody. I'll let you come on and give your viewpoint, and hopefully you're telling the truth. And because it's your story, right. I've never seen a UFO. We've had them here in our county in Ohio. Sure. So yeah, I do know that the cover-ups keep going on and on and on. And we're going to get it out in a little bit.
Yeah.
But when on your investigations, did you home and residential?
Residential. We did a couple of businesses, but it was rare to get into a business for us. It was mostly residential.
Well, what equipment did you like to use the best?
Boy, it was, I really liked the, we had a security night vision camera system, and I really like trying to catch something visual. And then of course, having audio recorders out quite a bit. We did have K2 meters and, some things that can detect, EMF activity, but we only put so much stock into that. And it's also really vital to educate homeowners on EMF bleed and what that can manifest and do to people that are susceptible to it,
and false reads and
exactly. And so what would be really cool, what we really liked using that type of equipment for, was if we had an experience and if something happened on that at the same time. That was pretty cool.
Anything demonic?
Boy, I really don't think so. Maybe one time we had something that felt a little bit aggressive, and we had some swearing on EVPs and swearing at people's names, using people's names. And that was really interesting and a little unsettling. I can't say for sure, obviously, if that was demonic, but some aggressiveness, especially with like some bangs and responsive bangs that seemed to kind of get out of hand. But again, we've come across some aggressive or maybe tired of our BS spirits, if you will.
There's people confuse on spirits that are angry or ornery,
right,
or just pissed off,
right.
So then that's not a demonic spirit,
right.
Yeah.
But there was this one house where we caught this picture. We had this really bad feeling of like this little storage room that was off the kitchen. So of course we had a recorder in there and, a night vision camera, a static one in there all night. But when we were in the kitchen, we had taken a break halfway through and we all went outside. I was a smoker at the time, this is like 14 years ago now, but so we go outside and we come back in and every drawer and cabinet door is open. And we're like, whoa, this is crazy, you know, because we weren't gone that long and we didn't hear anything because we were right on the porch. So we start taking some pictures, and one of us is capturing images of the door that leads into the storage room right off of the kitchen. There wasn't a door to it, just the door frame. And in that darkness, there appeared to us to be some sort of demonic looking face. And we were also very much aware of pareidolia. So we weren't sure, you know, we didn't want to put it out there to be like, see, we caught a demon, you know, but internally for us, we're like, that's pretty freaking creepy. You know,
I got to say, I love your podcast. I want to believe. That's a good title. And,
thank you.
I listened to a couple episodes, yesterday and today.
Nice.
The first one we'll get into is, Baba Vanga.
Baba Vanga.
Yeah. And that was mind blowing. I mean, yeah. Especially when you got into the predictions.
Yeah, that was crazy.
I was like, wow, you know.
And going way out, you know, like, you know, the third.
Oh, yeah, yeah. That was interesting. I never heard of that before until I listened to that.
That's awesome. Thank you.
Yeah. And the other one was the Black Eyed Kids.
Yeah, yeah. It's kind of like an ongoing series because besides UFOs, I believe BEKs and UFOs, for me personally, is like the last frontier of the paranormal for me. Mm-hmm. that actually creeped me out. I think I could add some dogman stories into that as well. Mm-hmm. But so I'd say those three things like freak me out. And I do a lot of stories on UFOs because that's kind of my bread and butter. That's like what I write books about and stuff. Mm. And I've done maybe two episodes on dogmen, but BEKs, there's so many stories that it's just been an ongoing series. So every year I do a series where, or I do an episode where I share, you know, 4 to 8 Black Eyed Kids stories. And, you know, I'm not sure which one you listen to, but.
I listened to the first one and yeah, the first one.
Okay.
I have the other one queued up to listen to later. And nice, I'm going to listen to every one of these because I'll get into that in a minute, you know.
Sure.
But the, because I can relate to that one because I only had experience with ghosts and spirits. And I never had one with a UFO. My friend that could never relate to my ghost stories, you know, I'm like, wait a minute, you don't believe my stories? Or he says, no. And then he got into it about his UFO experience. Here I am not really believing his stories. He's not believing my stories. You know, how weird is that? You know,
quite the duo.
His girlfriend, who he could never see. We never got to see her. And this time I knew that he was having telepathy series with these aliens. And then we're in like eighth grade. She was in a hallway. And I can remember step out in the hallway. That's the first time I seen her face to face because I came out in the hallway. And I looked right at her, and her eyes are completely black. He says, and he didn't say nothing. I turned back to look at her. She's gone. You know, so what the hell, man? So I finally got to talk to him later on about it. He says, she's off limits. We don't talk about her. And that's it. God, I really don't know. But yeah, I related to that Black Eyed Kid when I think in your episode, the kids were in the backseat. They disappeared.
Yeah.
So you would be thinking that's extraterrestrial, you know.
Yeah, or whatever the hell Black Eyed Kids are. You know, I don't.
What are they? I mean, yeah.
I don't know. I honestly don't know. And that's what I love about it. I love the alien theories. I love that they're like vampiric a little bit. I love that they're ghostly and ghastly a little bit, you know. It's really, really interesting. And as time goes on, they're becoming like the stories are getting more urban, which is really interesting. Mm-hmm. And hearing about sightings in public garages, you know, parking garages, within the hallways of apartment buildings is, you know, really creepy and interesting. And so I do like how they seem to be evolving with the times as well, which is interesting, you know.
What led you into podcasting? What got you into coming up with that title in your show?
Yeah, well, first of all, the title is because of the X-Files. You know, I was a geek for the X-Files. Even in high school, when I was too cool for school and I had to be out with my friends all the time, Friday night during the fall, I was either home watching the X-Files. I think it was 9 o'clock on Fox. Mm-hmm. And if I wasn't home, then I made sure that I set up the VCR to record it, or I would call my mom or dad frantically to be like, can't record on the VCR. And I'd come home. And when I got home, I'd watch it. So yeah, X-Files is why it's called I Want to Believe.
Oh, okay.
And because he had that famous poster, you know,
right.
And it said, I want to believe on it. And I think actually one of their movies is called I Want to Believe. I'm pretty sure. I can't remember if it's the first.
I remember issue. The poster. I don't remember the. I can't remember the movie though.
Yeah, but anyway, a huge X-Files fan, and it also kind of plays a double role because I don't believe everything. I'm really into the paranormal and fascinated by it. The umbrella term paranormal, you know. But I don't believe everything, you know what I mean? So
right.
I do. I want to believe. And I also try to share the stories on the podcast as a story, as I am storytelling, as opposed to this is fact and this happened, or here's what I believe. I just try to present the story and leave it up to the listener to decide what they believe, you know?
Yeah. I love learning on this show. Like, I just, you know, I'm going to be 70 this year. And it's like, you know, I'm still learning. I mean, I'm still learning. And once you think you've heard it all, you haven't.
Exactly, right. I got a good example of that too. Yeah. I'll tell you that in a second. But as far as like podcasting, I've been a musician like for as long as I can remember. And I put out, you know, a whole bunch of albums, and I actually haven't done that in a while. Like once I started writing, that kind of took over, and, you know, getting books published and stuff like that. So the music kind of went on the back burner. I still produce music, and it's usually like the background music for some of the podcast stuff. But I haven't been making albums or singles or anything lately. But podcasting did really scratch that audio itch that I love so much, you know. So that it was a really easy transition. Plus, a buddy and I who started the podcast together, we would often talk for hours about paranormal subjects. And finally, I was like, can I shove some mics in front of our faces and... You know, we do a podcast about it, and it's, you know, over time, I'm sure you've seen the quality of it. If you listen to some early stuff and now some later stuff, you know, it's evolved into really scripted storytelling that's overproduced music wise, you know, and to give some ambiance and, you know, try to make it an interesting listening experience, you know, with soundscapes and stuff.
Well, I put it on my library, so it's I can listen to it now.
That's awesome.
Yeah, I see that you're starting your seventh season. That's pretty cool, man. Congratulations.
Yeah. Thank you.
I started my sixth.
You know? Oh, cool. Congrats to you.
I'm a one-man show. I don't know if you are.
I am, yeah.
So you know what it is to edit and record and produce.
I do all the audio and I do all the soundscapes and editing, but I also obviously research everything because, you know, I don't have guests on, I tell stories. So I research everything and then I write a script, you know, and it's just such a process that I can really only do one a month because it takes so long, you know, like one episode can take me like 8 hours, you know, start to finish. And so I think one a month is fine for me. You know, if somebody wants to like start paying me a boatload of money, okay, I'll try doing it once a week, but you know.
Right. I mean, if we were in for the money, we'd both be broke, you know.
Yeah.
But the I see that your wife, I think, was on. Is it your wife or?
It's my girlfriend.
Your girlfriend was on the one album. I think it was
The Baba Vanga one.
Yeah, right. And I think earlier ones, you had some other guy with you.
Yeah, that's my buddy.
Okay.
He's my best friend in the world. However, he moved like 3 hours northwest of me, and where he is, he's got like really, really poor internet. So it makes it really tough for us to record online. And getting together gets kind of tough. So last season, his appearances were sporadic. And this season, I'm not sure he's going to be able to make it on at all. And then there was the COVID season, and he didn't make it on to that at all either, which is too bad.
I see you said, yeah, you said you were a musician. I did listen to a couple of your songs. I came across your...
I'm so sorry.
No. It was Monday and Tuesday.
Oh, yeah.
And that was background music. I thought it was pretty cool. Because I went to New York about... I don't know, 20, 30 years. I can't remember. But you know how you get your Broadway shows and everybody goes to see, you know, whatever.
Yeah.
And we didn't have that type of money. So we went down one of these little alley, like your.
Yeah.
Well, it was one on, it was a ghost story. They had a live band that played down in the pit.
Oh, cool.
But it was like a mosh pit, you know. and it went perfect with there was a play and the band playing was perfect to what they were doing on stage. I bought the CD, the band CD, you know. I says, and it was like low budget, but it was, I really enjoyed myself, you know.
That's awesome.
But I do like, I give you credit for doing the background music and doing all that. I mean, that's
It's a good time.
Takes, I mean, I'm one musician to another. I know the work that's involved, and
I appreciate it. Yeah.
What's your thoughts on the missing people and involving the 411 cases?
Oh yeah, yeah. Well, first of all, this could be controversial, but I have no problem saying it amongst people that I'm around. So I'm sure it's okay on a podcast, but I'm not the biggest fan of David Politis. There are some big assumptions that some of his conclusions take, I feel. This is just, me personally. And there are some opinions of his that don't have to do with the missing 411 stuff that I'm also not a big fan of. But save for all that, because missing 411 in David Politis, they are not one and the same anymore. It's grown bigger than what he is. He's obviously still the face of it, but there's so many stories out there, and I find it fascinating. I absolutely adore and reading missing 411 stories. And I've done a couple of podcast episodes on them, and I like finding the stories on Reddit where Politis hasn't had his hands on them, and try to find something a little fresh and raw. And with the storms coming in Boulder fields I feel like there's a lot of cherry picking when it comes to, all of these cases have all of that in common when they actually don't, So I don't take a whole lot of stock in that. What I take stock into is when, especially, there's like a group of people and one person seemingly steps into a portal and is just gone, and searches happen and they're not found. And then months later, their dead body is found right where they were searching before, or it's a couple days later and a live person, they're still alive, is found and they don't know. There's a fascinating story. I call it Robot Grandma. But it's this fascinating story about this little boy. He's 2 years old and he goes missing in a national park, and his parents are freaking out and they're looking for him. And they call in relatives because they lived in town. It's not like they did this big trip to a national park. It was just in their backyard, basically. So they call family and friends to come over and help look, and they can't find him. It's getting dark. And so they know they have to call search and rescue. So they come in, they're looking everywhere. And about 11 p.m. at night, the kid went missing like at 2 p.m. About 11 p.m. at night, the kid is found just a mile down a path. Searchers have gone down numerous times. Mom and dad have gone down that same path numerous times. And the kid was just sitting there alive and well, So a few weeks later, grandmother is babysitting the 2-year-old, and the kid says to, like, grandma's like cooking him dinner or something. And the kid says, "I don't like the other grandma." And she's like, "What?" And he's like, "Yeah, when they couldn't find me in the woods, someone who looked like you came and got me, and they brought me to this cave. And inside the cave were all these purses and guns. Mm-hmm. And there was this ladder, and you climbed up the ladder. And when you got up there, you grabbed this piece of sticky paper and you asked me to poop on it. And I told you no. So you got mad at me and you took me back out to the trail and you said, 'Sit here and somebody will find you.'" That's the kid's story.
Wow. Yeah.
It's so weird. It's so weird.
Something similar where a kid was missing, and where he was found, there's no way he could have got there in that amount of time because it was so far away. So he couldn't have walked or ran there because of the terrain and the distance. A lot of people say it could be extraterrestrial connected or Bigfoot connected. I really don't know. I mean, I've just been starting to, because it fascinates me, there's so Same many, way. There's so many.
And it really feels like there's this cavernous system, tunnels or something, and a creature is taking them. I can get behind that. I don't think Politis is crazy for spouting that, and he honestly didn't really spout that for years and years and years, and I gotta say, even though I talk a little BS on Politis, I've watched both of his missing 411 documentaries, and I absolutely loved them. When he can just stick to the facts and stay off camera.
Sometimes they have the theatrical, put a lot of theater in it for selling the show, you know.
Yeah. But I absolutely enjoyed those documentaries, and Les Stroud getting involved and having his opinions, which I do respect. I mean, Survivor Man, you got to respect that.
Well, we're going to take a short break, and we're going to continue our conversation on your books that are out, and also a little bit on the Senate hearings on the UFO. We'll be back after these brief messages.
Hey, everyone. Eric here. I am the host of the Unseen Paranormal Podcast. Join me for a new episode every Wednesday as I delve into the unseen world with historians, authors, researchers, and investigators as we try to understand and make sense of the paranormal. You can listen to past and future episodes on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, iHeartRadio, Stitcher, or at unseenparanormalpodcast.com. Please like the show on Facebook and share with your friends. And remember, some of the scariest things are unseen.
Okay, I'm back with Namar Slevic. We were talking about 411 cases and UFO or Bigfoot related. With the new Senate hearings that was just released, the latest ones, I believe it was David Grush was talking about the maybe the bodies that were recovered.
Yeah.
Again, the cover-up. And I was looking back a few days ago just on some of the past presidents, Jimmy Carter and Obama and Trump. You know, they're all saying they can't talk about it.
Yeah.
You know, and you wonder what is classified that, well, maybe sometimes I think, you know, some things should be classified and not put out there only because the public can't handle it. I wish they would have went a little deeper on the topics. And I know he couldn't do it because, you know, he said his life was threatened.
Yeah. Yeah.
This group that they put together, you know, research these UFOs were put together by the Pentagon, right? I mean, by Congress. I mean, they put these groups together so they can come to some type of understanding of what's going on. I mean,
yeah.
So what's your thought on what came out of the hearings?
Well, there's been a few hearings, obviously, and the latest was the most dramatic, you know. I guess to start off, just the admittance that there was, you know, a secret band of people in the Pentagon that were still looking into UFO stuff way after Project Blue Book closed. And, you know, they did it with, you know, money hidden within, you know, DOD and things like that. Really interesting. And that was a fascinating article, you know, Leslie Keene and Ralph Blumenthal, and fascinating stuff. And it, you know, that was really the triggering point of blowing all of this out of the water and getting UFOs back into the mainstream, but more importantly, getting UFOs talked about in a serious way within the government where maybe actual disclosure could maybe be a thing. I kind of gave up personally in my own work on disclosure. I much more prefer now to speak with the experiencer and get those types of stories and share those types of stories. But I am also glued to the television anytime that stuff is on. So these latest hearings with Grush, and I think it was Fever.
Yeah.
Yeah. And the other guy, Graves, I think.
Graves. Yeah.
And really like those two. Grush, he's lockstep with Corbell and Knapp. And
he can't say, I think, what he wants to say.
Yeah, but I guess for me, being, you know, and honestly, like, everything he's saying could be true, could not be true. It is a whole lot of fantastic stuff with absolutely no backup. And he says his hands are tied for that backup, which to me screams all too convenient, if you will, a conspiracy within a conspiracy, if you will. And to be in lockstep with Corbell, Knapp, I used to adore Knapp and love Knapp, and his work with Skinwalker and Lazar and all that stuff is really interesting. But where he's kind of took Corbell under his wing, and, you know, they're almost in UFO entertainment at this point. And Corbell is releasing all these unsanctioned videos. It seems like they were a bit helpful at the beginning with some of the videos, but now, like that jellyfish one, you know, that was making the rounds, it's come out from quite a few experts, especially within like retired military, that those are balloons and that it's a type of balloon. And I can't remember if it was Islam or what faith it was. And they showed them side by side. But Corbell was really singing the praises that this was a UFO and it dived in the water. And then he's got some of that footage where this jellyfish UFO went in the water, but it doesn't look like a jellyfish UFO anymore. So that was concerning. Anyway, so when someone becomes lockstep with somebody that I feel, again, this is just all personal feelings, you know, just my opinion. When somebody becomes lockstep with somebody like a Corbell or somebody that's in UFO-tainment, you know, like the Nick Popes of the world, the man can't say no to anything. Mm-hmm. Like those types of people, I have a hard time trusting it. But at the same time, Corbell's got such a wide reach within the UFO community and the mainstream. He's a great liaison that it does feel helpful, but I am leery of it. I guess all of that to say is I'm leery of Grush's stories, you know, and if we can get just some evidence, just the 10% evidence on anything he was saying, I think I could buy into it more. And I know that's probably annoying to some listeners, but that's how I feel.
Well, that's good. Yeah. Well, and it just comes out to evidence and instead of somebody's hearsay, or does he know that where these places are, where these bodies are being held? A lot of people keep saying it's Wright-Patterson Air Force Base. It's like, everything else is there, you know. But I go by, like you saying, people you put stock into that have seen it or have been there.
Right.
Just like a couple of years ago, my wife and I went to, I don't know if you ever heard of it, it's called Kecksburg, Pennsylvania.
Oh, yeah, of course.
And we went there for the Kecksburg UFO Festival.
Awesome.
And that was a lot. Stan Gordon. And I met Stan Gordon, and I bought his DVD there. I bought a couple of his books. He's been on my show.
Awesome.
My best part of the whole weekend was the people I talked to. That was alive in 1965.
Oh my God, yeah.
That witnessed this, that cannot come on the show, cannot talk about it.
Yeah, yeah.
It wasn't them as an adult. It was them as a child.
Right.
That was in the house when the men in black came in their house.
Yeah.
Used their phone. And then when they were all done, when their parents were like, what the hell? You know, so they were looking at their phone records and those records aren't there.
Right.
So, you know, and what they had witnessed a truck being pulled out with some type of capsule on it.
Right.
You know, so these are people I like talking to. They're not making a buck off of this. They're not making any money. They're not trying to make a name for themselves. They're talking to little old me down in the cornfield, talking to some people that don't really want to be on camera, but they're sharing me their stories. And every single one of those stories were the same.
Yeah.
So, you know, and that wasn't some staged show or political event, you know.
Right. And, you know, I love Kecksburg witnesses with how they tell their stories, and it rivals Roswell witnesses, you know, seeing some of those past interviews. I mean, that Kecksburg story is just phenomenal. And what Stan Gordon has done for that entire area, the stories he's uncovered and connections that he's made. Fascinating stuff.
There's a lot of research.
Yeah.
I always said he was way ahead of his time, you know, because he was using the radio transmission back and forth for his people that was investigating. Like you're saying, it's so much harder to investigate a UFO sighting than, say, sitting in a haunted house or, and I've always said to a haunted house, going on investigations, it's like going fishing. You know, sometimes you get it, sometimes you don't. Yeah. Most times you don't, you know, or it's not haunted at all. Right. You know, but they're the ones that are, you know, because, you know, the one before that, the Senate hearing before that, when they had like 23 cases they went through, and
I think it was 148, something like that. And then out of those 148, there were 23 that really
23.
Cut their
and
interest.
only one they concluded was a weather balloon.
Right. And
so what happened to the other 22?
Yeah, there's five different categories, but they've switched names and staff so much since that initial one that it's a little hard to keep up with to the best of my knowledge now with Arrow, I think they are AARO.
Oh, that was Arrow. That was with Grush. I was thinking that. I was thinking about that. That was Arrow.
And the 148, that was with ATIP, I believe. And the 22 fell into, or actually all 148 fell into one of five categories, and four of the categories were basically man-made or natural. And then there was this other category where those 23 others like fell into, you know, where it could have been something unknown. Doesn't mean it was, it's not man-made or natural, but it's at least unknown for the time being, you know? And I think up until the latest hearing, it might be up to 600 or 800 reports now. And I'm sure it's even bypassed that, you know, now. Mm-hmm. And I don't know how many are in that other category or if they've changed categories. I know they came up with a new word called transmedium, you know, mm-hmm. and that's for stuff that goes in the water and the air and all that stuff. But
yeah.
But yeah, fascinating stuff. And anytime it's on, I'll watch it.
Me too.
I'll take a bunch of notes. And sometimes I'll get called by local media to be like, hey, what are your thoughts on this, you know, UFO dude? And I'm like, well, here's what I think. And yeah, but Grush, I will say, much like my podcast, I want to believe him. I don't know if I do.
I'm on the same boat with you. Yeah. You know, speaking of boats, I mean, in the water, we had talked about the UFOs going into the submersibles going into the water. Now, I'm going back 55, 57 years when I was talking about my friend Alex and his UFO experiences. Mm-hmm. Now, we had touched on this years ago. And on our river that runs through our town, it's called the Mahoning River. The word was that the UFO was going into the water behind our log cabin in the middle of our town. And that's how it gets its energy, is from the water.
Mm.
Now, so I'd never seen it. But then I've had guests on my show over the past 6 years and how it all leads back to the water.
Mm.
You know, like you'll see a lot of Bigfoot sightings are somehow near a UFO sighting. If it's near water, you know,
right.
Your thoughts on that? Maybe if Bigfoot is connected with UFOs or cryptids.
Yeah, I think that's definitely possible. And I think the gentleman we were just speaking about before, Stan Gordon, has uncovered a lot of fascinating stories that relate Bigfoot to UFOs. He's even got some crazy one. You know, it's not his story. He, you know, found it from a witness, but a Bigfoot was hanging from some sort of rope that was attached to a UFO. And I was like, what?
Yeah. I've got two of his books and I think like the Thunderbirds. I never heard of the Thunderbird.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
You know,
that's fascinating.
Stuff. Right. 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 So, I've got, you know, he was really interesting to be honest. It was even more interesting talking to him at the festival.
Oh, I bet.
Because I said, hey, man, I've seen you on, it was UFO Sessions or something.
Yeah, yeah. And he did the stuff with Small Town Monsters, which was great.
Yeah. Yeah. And I went and I just got to see the replica of the UFO. It's in Kecksburg.
Yeah, yeah. the big acorn thing.
Right, right. And it was really a nice weekend. Awesome. Not just there's people walk around as aliens and it's a fun time.
Yeah.
But,
A big one that's kind of near me. It's actually like 4 hours away, actually. And I've actually never gone. But I know a lot of the people that participate. And it's the Exeter UFO Festival down in New Hampshire. And it's, you know, honoring that Exeter, New Hampshire sighting that was huge. And it technically happened in Kensington. But, you know, the police were involved. Really fascinating stuff. But I love it when there's, you know, a big event surrounded by or because of a UFO or cryptid event or something, you know.
Now, speaking of UFOs, let's get to your books.
Sure.
I don't know. I might have came across your book somewhere, and it was UFOs Over Maine. Sure. And it fascinated me because after all these years of doing this, you know, I have had UFOs over New York, over Washington, D.C., out west, Utah, you know, never Maine. I was like, wow, that was interesting, you know. And I says, I gotta check this dude out. And I think came across your book, and I was like, I got to get it yet. Have to order. I think it came out just on a 10-year anniversary.
Yeah.
Yeah. What's that cool book? What was the book? Just you're just covering Maine?
Yep. Yeah. So it was actually a book that was really like 25 years in the making. I just didn't know it at the time. Mm-hmm. But, you know, when I was 12 or 13, I told you that's when I kind of thought about that lightning bolt was maybe a UFO. And And I was like, that really fascinates me. So I started seeking out, besides ghosts and Bigfoot and Nessie and Bermuda Triangle, I really started getting into UFOs. So I started collecting as many stories as I could. And of course, it was easy to collect some of the bigger ones, like Allagash abductions that happened, Travis Walton that happened, Benny Barney Hill that happened, and Exeter. And, you know, so it was a lot of stuff to latch on to. But then I was just fiending for my own area. has there been something in the state, you know? And the Allagash abductions was a huge one that was covered on Unsolved Mysteries. When Joan Rivers had her talk show on, she had those boys on. And so that was really big. It wasn't as big as, you know, Travis Walton case and some other cases, but it was pretty big. And it happened in Maine. And, you know, I didn't know that at the time, you know, being pretty young and sheltered, you know, like, is Allagash part of Maine? Well, it turns out it was actually just like the next town over from where I grew up. Mm-hmm. And so I thought that was fascinating to find that out at a really young age. And so I started collecting more and more stories. And it was probably, I was in my 20s finally. And I had all these stories that I collected. And I'm sitting there and I'm looking at my bookshelf, which is full of local books on ghosts. And that's really what Maine had at that time was for paranormal books, was books on ghosts. There was one book by an author named C.J. Stevens. It's a fascinating book. I love it. It's out of print, but it's called The Supernatural Side of Maine. If you can find it on Amazon, or more importantly, at some sort of mom and pop store, you can use indiebook.org, and you can do a search there. But anyway, C.J. Stevens, The Supernatural Side of Maine. He had ghost stories, but he also had werewolf stories. And he also had, you know, Lady in White stories. And he also had UFO stories. And some of those were from Maine and some of those were right in my backyard too. And I was like, oh man, okay, so C.J. Stevens got some stories. I have a whole crap ton of stories. I'm looking at that bookshelf. There's no book on UFOs solely dedicated in Maine. I'm going to write that book. And I sort of haphazardly, you know, because I didn't know what I was doing. So I was haphazardly putting things together. And I was really just kind of writing out a longer version of a police beat entry or of a really short case that I heard of or whatever. And then that slowly started to evolve. And I ended up having a whole bunch of cases that kind of fit together neatly into a manuscript. I still didn't really know what one looked like, so I Googled it and found a whole bunch of information. I was able to put it together as much as I could. And then I was like, well, how am I going to get this out here? You know, I know about being an independent musician and it's easy to make your own music and make it, well, not easy, but it's more accessible to make your own CD or even vinyl and get that out there. But a book, a publisher's got to put your book out, don't they? So I looked at that bookshelf and I'm like, oh, well, all these guys are in Maine and they're putting out ghost books. Maybe they want to put out a UFO book. So I sent my manuscript to, I don't know, 15, 20 people and never heard back from a bunch of them. Got some no's from a couple of them. So I'm like, okay, what am I going to do? And, this is a really condensed process, but, you know, this was over months and years, you know, trying to get this thing off the ground. So finally I was doing some research on self-publishing and, you know, there's vanity publishers and
right.
You know, I'm the quintessential struggling writer, you know, so funds don't come naturally to me.
Right.
So a vanity press wasn't going to work. And I now know the negativity associated with a vanity press, but at the time I didn't. But anyways, you know, pay somebody $1,000 to write, you know, to put out your book sounds insane at the time. So I couldn't do that. So I found a company called CreateSpace, who is actually owned by Amazon. It's now called KDP. It's Kindle Direct. Uh-huh. And, but it was CreateSpace at the time. So all you do is upload your manuscript and you try to make it look pretty and you can make your own cover and do all this stuff. So I did that. And then I ordered what's called a proof copy to make sure the book looks okay. Uh-huh. And, you know, it's just one copy they print and send to you. On the day that I got the proof copy, I got an email from a publishing house saying, we're interested in putting your book out.
Oh, cool, man.
I was like, what the coincidence, the synchronicity of that. You know? So I'm holding a tangible book and I'm looking at an email, you know, and I had to go with the traditional publisher. I just had to. I had to see what that experience was like. Mm-hmm. And it's long and arduous and tedious, and I'm so glad I did it. And it took about another year or year and a half for them to put that book out, and there was lots of editing and chopping it down. And, you know, it wasn't my best work. Obviously, it was my first book. I read it now, and I cringe. And that came out in 2014.
Oh, yeah.
It's 2024, so 2 years ago, looking back at that book, after finishing a horror book that I had just put out, a horror fiction book that did terrible, because I'm basically known for like nonfiction UFO books, and all of a sudden I put out a random horror fiction book. Uh-huh. It did awful. You know, I barely made any money off of it. So not feeling very good about myself and not knowing what I should do next. You know, I was kind of looking at the work that I had done and maybe trying not to feel so bad. Like, hey, at least you did that. You know what I mean? And I'm looking at UFOs over Maine and I'm like, oh man, in 2 years, because it was like 2022, mm-hmm. in 2 years, it's going to be the 10-year anniversary. Like there's something here. So I read the book again and I cringed and I'm like, oh my God. Okay. So I can't just do a reprint. I'm out of contracts with everything. So I could have, if I wanted to, uh-huh. but I did not. It was too cringe. So I decided to scrap the whole thing and rewrite it. On top of that, I decided to add as many new stories, new to me, that I could find. Tried to add as many never before published stories that I could find. And for the stories that were already in the original book, I tried to find more and more information, more witnesses, so I could have a more fleshed out story for the original ones. All of that was accomplished within 2 years. And right now, it's in fundraising mode, but UFOs Over Maine 10th anniversary edition is now finished, and it's over 400 pages and has almost 200 encounters. And we're talking abductions, Men in Black scenarios. There's even a chapter about a family who experienced werewolves or dogmen on their property. So lots of really interesting stuff, and it's in fundraising mode. So I have a GoFundMe that's out right now, and it's $32, includes shipping and tax, and you can get a copy, a signed copy of the book.
So you're going outside of traditional publishing. You're going to soft publishing on this one?
Yeah. Sorry, I skipped a whole lot I skipped like 10 years of telling you stuff. So the first UFOs Over Maine came out. That was a really great process. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And it took, you know, like realistically, it took me like 6 years to write that book, and the writing process and the editing process and working with the publisher was really interesting, but also like tedious and weird. And it took a lot to get used to. And once it was all said and done, and you could actually get my book at Walmart and all these really strange places, I never thought I would have a book. I got my first check from them and I'm like, oh, so this sucks, yeah. You know, that was a whole lot of work for this. And I'm sorry, you know, like I'm not in it for the money, but I do have to, you know, pay rent.
And you want to cover your crosses that you put into it.
Of course.
At least, you know, get your money back, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. Cause you know, driving around the state, it's a big state, you know what I mean? but to fill in a little bit of the gaps of the 10 years. So UFOs Over Maine, that came out, and that was fun and great. Getting paid kind of sucked, but at least I made something, you know what I mean? And they were pretty quick to be like, okay, well, what's next? And I had a few different ideas, and they weren't really interested in some of those. But I also, there was hundreds of stories on the chopping block, and I'm like, I'm just going to turn that into UFOs Over Maine too.
Right.
You know, that made sense to me because it was still a lot of great, fascinating stories. So I started working on that, and eventually they're like, it's pretty clear that that's what you want to do, but we're not interested. So we're going to pass. And I'm like, well, crap. Now it's back to the drawing board. Like you have to start all over looking for a new publisher, you know? Mm-hmm. So it was cool that I wasn't under contract anymore and I could take my book elsewhere. And I did find another publishing house. They're a little bit bigger than the ones before, so that felt like a step up. Mm-hmm. And they didn't want to call it UFOs Over Maine 2 because a different publishing house put that out. So we called it Otherworldly Encounters. But it was all Maine stories again. So that was really great. And went through that whole process. There are another great group of people to work with and all that good stuff. But again, the pay sucked. And I'm like, okay, something's got to give here. You know what I mean? So I started working on my next book after Otherworldly Encounters. And that was about a gentleman from New Hampshire. And that's called Granite Skies. And instead of a collection of stories from all types of people, this is one man's story where he's been dealing with extraterrestrial activity his entire life. And so it's basically a biography on him. And I brought that to the publishing house and they're like, yeah, great. We want to put it out. And I'm like, okay, well, here are my terms. This is the second book. The first one did kind of okay. Here's what I'm thinking for the second book. And they're like, no, No, of course not. It's the same terms. I'm like, the same terms? That was like 3 years ago. I mean, even cost of living. Like, what are you talking about? They're like, nope, this is what it is. Wow. And I couldn't believe it. We went back and forth quite a bit. And the subject of the book, I wanted to keep them in the loop. So we talked about it quite a bit. I was like, I don't know if we can go with these guys, man. You know, also, they're not giving me final approval on the manuscript, not giving me final approval even on the title or the cover. I'm like, no, this is our story. This is your story. We got to put it out the way we want. So I'm going to walk away. And he's like, cool, okay. And that's when I first started looking into self-publishing again. And ever since then, I've been doing self-publishing because the money is a lot better. And I can get the story out a lot quicker. With a publishing house, you're at the mercy of their release schedule, and it could be a year or two before your title comes out. So when I'm done with the book, boom, I'm going to put it out. And it's, you know, it's still a process, but it's a lot easier.
I came across another book. I don't know if it's yours, just the same name. We Only Come Out at Night.
Yeah, that's the horror fiction book.
That's a horror fiction. Okay, I came across that one. I was going to ask you about that because I have the Granite Skies and UFOs Over Maine and the other unworldly encounters. I had those written down.
Yeah,
but I was going to ask you about the We Only Come Out at Night. You said it didn't do very well.
Yeah, it didn't do very well. It's horror fiction. That's actually what I've been writing since I was a kid. You know, horror fiction, and you know that I told you the origin story for, you know, UFOs Over Maine. So, but I thought it'd be fun to try it. And, you know, I liked the process of it, but it just didn't do well, you know? So I have to do that when it makes sense for me, you know, financially. So, you know, I probably won't do one for a little bit, the horror fiction, but this year I've got UFOs Over Maine 10th anniversary edition, completely rewritten, all new stories. It's got all the original stories, but they're all expanded and never before published. And it's in fundraising mode. So I have a GoFundMe, that you can go and like donate, but you're donating to get a copy of the book, you know, and that's going, you know, it could be going, you know, a lot better, but, you know, it is what it is. And it's, you know, I'll also be doing some library appearances during the year and stuff and having the books.
Send me a link to that. I will put that in the bottom of the links.
I appreciate it.
I want to thank you for coming on the show today, man. It's my pleasure to have you on. And I love your podcast. Your books sound very interesting. I'm going to wait till the 10th anniversary edition comes out and get that UFO Over Maine. And like I said, I'll put all these links in the bottom of this episode.
I appreciate that. And you've been an absolute pleasure to talk to. I loved hearing, you know, what you've had to say for stories and all that cool stuff. So this has been very cool. Thank you so much.
Please check out Namar Slevik's links at the bottom of this episode, where you can purchase his books, listen to his podcast, and I'm sure I will talk to him again in the future. Please rate and review Ghost in the Valley on Apple Podcasts. I would really appreciate that. Until next time, this is Al Cooley from Ghost in the Valley Podcast.